So today we're going to look at Unit 7, Lesson 4, and we're also going to set our diary for the next few weeks for the closed book exam and the presentations. So I'll explain now, and I'll explain also at the end when everyone is here. So if you've got diaries or you want to note these down, this week we're doing Lesson 4 of Unit 7. Then next week, which will be the 23rd, we'll do Lesson 5, which is the last lesson of Unit 7. And then the following week, which will be the Saturday the 30th of July, we will do the closed book exam for Unit 7. Right. And now we'll do that at 2 o'clock. We'll do that at 2 o'clock, and then from 3 o'clock the students can continue to in their groups to prepare for their group presentation, and which will actually be presented on the following week, the 6th of August. Right, now the 6th of August, in effect, you are doing there'll be a few groups, and in your group you do a group presentation for half an hour, and each group will get the same mark that group gets. So if they get 80%, each member gets 80%. In effect, Unit 8, there's no closed book exam, and the essays which are meant to be done in this Unit 7 actually form the presentation for Unit 8. See? So in essence, you don't necessarily have to do the essays to be separately marked for Unit 7, because they're actually, those essays become your presentation in Unit 8. And there's no closed book exam for Unit 8. So really Unit 7 and Unit 8 are combined. Right? So if we take Unit 7 and Unit 8 combined, there's just one closed book exam, which is for Unit 7, and the essays will be done as a presentation, which is the entirety of Unit 8. So we'll get through Unit 8 very quickly. No, there's no essays to hand in and no closed book exams. Yeah? Just that presentation. That's the entirety of Unit 8. And that presentation really is what you would usually do for the essays in Unit 7 actually becomes your presentation. Right? So, now what that means is that this week we do Unit 4, none of the open book questions come up in this lesson for Unit 7, and next week we do the final lesson, and within that lesson there are the three remaining open book questions, essay questions, two of which have been selected for doing group presentations. So next week's a very important lesson as far as understanding, you know, the subject matter of questions 3 and 4 of your, you know, your essay questions. So for instance, your essay questions are for unit 7. 3 is discuss the relevance for preaching of the destruction of the Yadu dynasty with reference to, and it gives you the you know, chapter 3, text 14, 15, chapter 3, text 24, 28, and chapter 4, text 2 and 3. So that question there, some groups will be doing that question as their presentation. And other groups will be doing this question, which is 4, discuss how Uddhava being advised to go to Bhadarikashram reflects Prabhupada's mood and is relevant for our practice of spiritual life. Right? And the references are there from chapter 4, text 4, 21, 30 to 32. Right?
Canto 3 or Canto 4?
Yeah, they're all Canto 3. And the first, that open book essay question 3, which is the references are there from chapters 3 and 4. And the fourth question, the references are chapter 4 from Canto 3. Now, we will also discuss next week open book question 2, which is, but it doesn't come up, no one has to do this as a class presentation. Discuss with reference to chapter 4, text 24 and 26, the relevance of ISKCON for the offence of Mariyada Vyatikramma. The first two questions you will actually have to hand in as essays. Alright? Question 1 and 2 you do have to hand in as essays for Unit 7. And question 3 and 4, those essays form a presentation which can, you know, are in fact the entirety of Unit 8. Alright? So next week we'll actually be going over those questions, because we've only covered one so far, and that was in relationship to the second canto. So next week we'll actually go over all those open book question subject matters from chapters 3 and 4 of canto 3, and we'll also look at the various homework questions in preparation for the exam, and we can also discuss a little bit more about the class presentations. So at the end of today's lesson, what we'll do is we'll spend a bit of time and go over what you actually expected to do in those class presentations. But for now, we will continue with our discussion on Canto 3, Chapters 1 and 2. If we get time today, what I'd like to do is to get you to prepare a little 5-minute presentation. Hopefully, we'll So that on chapter 2, I hope you read chapter 2 thoroughly. What's that? Yeah. Anyway, what I'll do is at the end of this class, I'll give you a few minutes. and I'll give you certain sections each, and you can just look at those few verses and just a little 5-minute presentation, and we can get a little bit of feedback, and that may help you as a preparation for the big half an hour presentation. So we've described so far what we're doing in our diaries over the next month, and at the end of the class I'm going to go over a lot more thoroughly what you need to do in your groups for the group presentation. But for now we're going to actually just look at, first we're going to discuss chapter 1, right, hopefully we get time, I'd like you to do a little 5-minute presentation based on some of the things from chapter 2. Alright. Okay. Now, after hearing all about the creation as discussed between Sukadeva Goswami and Maharaj Parikit in the second canto, Shanaka Rishi inquired from Sudha Goswami about Vidura. So at the end of the second canto, chapter 10, the Rishis asked Sudha Goswami about Vidura. That had come up way back in the 13th chapter of the first canto. Text number 1, I think it was, that Sudha Goswami had informed the Rishis how Vidura had left home. Now, at the end of the second canto, the Rishis asked, you know, what are the activities of Vidura while he was on places of pilgrimage? What was the reason for his giving up the connection with his family members? And why did he again come home? And most of those will be answered in chapter 1. So we'll cover that today. And the fourth question was what topics were discussed between Vidura and Maitreya? And, you know, the answer to that question will take us right through cantos 3 and 4. So, just a brief overview of the chapters today. First of all, very briefly, and then we'll go over a little bit more detail. Vidura recommends Yudhisthira's share of the kingdom be returned to Yudhisthira and Duryodhana expelled. Sorry. Duryodhana insulted Vidura, who had suggested that to him, and ordered him to be thrown out of the palace. Vidura places his bow at the door and left to travel on pilgrimage. Now, at Prabhasa Setra, Vidura hears that the Kauravas and the Yadus have been annihilated to extinction due to fratricidal wars, and on the bank of the Jamuna he met Uddhava. Vidura inquires from Uddhava about the Yadavas in Dwarka and the Pandavas, and Vidura requests Uddhava to chant the glories of the Lord. So that's chapter 1. Chapter 2, basically being requested by Vidura, Uddhava became absorbed in ecstasy and describes Krishna's disappearance, the super excellent nature of Krishna's pastimes in the material world, and Krishna's appearance and Krishna's Vrindavan pastimes. So that's the summary of what we're looking at today. So, But let's start at the beginning of chapter 1, the first five verses. Maharaj Parikit, of course, first of all inquires from Sukadeva Goswami about the conversation between Vidura and Maitreya. Okay, let's test our studies of chapter 1. Now, Sukadeva Goswami is actually speaking this information, but it's actually being the sages, the rishis, have asked Sukadeva Goswami. And Sukadeva Goswami is answering their questions by, you know, replying that Parikit Maharaj asked the same questions. So let's hear what Sukadeva Goswami said to him. Sukadeva Goswami gradually says that, you know, Vidura asked these questions to Maitreya, so I'm going to give you the reply, Parikit Maharaj, through that conversation. So conversation, the first lot of questions and answers were actually given by the conversation with Vidura and Uddhava. That was repeated by Sukadeva Goswami when Parikit asked the same questions of Vidura, and that was repeated again when the sages asked Sutta the same. Okay, I think I'm just referring back. So it swaps back and forth, but in essence, you know, you can take it that, of course, Sukadeva Goswami is speaking in Srimad Bhagavatam, so you can take it that Sukadeva Goswami is speaking about this whole conversation right through this chapter. Or you can take it that Sukadeva Goswami is repeating it, like that. And in some cases, you hear exactly what Uddhava and Vidura said. The sages wanted to know, why did Vidura leave home? So we'll get to that. But first of all, an interesting point is made in the purport to the second verse that let's read the actual translation. Feels good, doesn't it? Hey, holding the third canto. Just feel that nectar. Hey, look at that. How do you get a little flutter in your heart when you? Let's all just hold the book for a second. Just relish that. Oh, third can. That's nice. It's there. Hang on to those laptops. It's all in there. That's right. Hey? You get the entire Bhagavatam. So. Now, first of all, the verse here says, what else is there to say about the residential house of the Pandavas? Sri Krishna, the Lord of everything, acted as your minister. He used to enter that house as if it were his own, and he did not take any care of Duryodhana's house. Oh. So Krishna acted as a minister of the Pandavas. Sukadeva Goswami is speaking to Pariksit Maharaj. The Pariksit Maharaj is the grandson of the Pandavas. The Dura himself is also intimately related with the Pandavas. We'll see that relationship actually later on. Now, Vidura in effect has left home. The astonishing thing is he's leaving a home that Krishna, you know, frequents regularly. As Prabhupada puts it here, the Lord identified the house with his own self, thus the house of the Pandavas was as good as Vrindavan. In essence, one may question, Vidura should not have given up that place of transcendental bliss. But we see that the disturbance that was created there, Vidura actually took advantage of that family misunderstanding for higher realization. So it's an interesting situation. We should also understand, of course, that Krishna also, at some stage in the Mahabharata, the story, we see he actually rejected Duryodhana's house and went to Vidura's house, even though actually Vidura hadn't invited him, but Krishna wouldn't stay at Duryodhana's because of seeing, you know, the nature of the offences. And so, in essence, you know, Vidura has given up his own home, which Krishna has, just accepted as his own home. Just like, you know, there are certain relatives and friends you can just walk in uninvited and just sit down and treat the place as your home. You know, so Krishna did that at that. At Vidura's place, and of course at the Pandavas, so they're intimately connected. But Vidura left his own home, and you know, literally the palace of the Pandavas, everyone's home, and went away. So it's quite astonishing, but the point being that there was an opportunity for coming to a higher level of spiritual realization, spiritual advancement. So that he could ultimately, fully surrender to Krishna and fully relish the service of Lord Sri Krishna. And we'll see as we go through the chapter that, in effect, Vidura needed to free himself from all other distractions that were going, you know, the politics and the intrigues and, you know, family relationships and what have you, so that he could just have a single-minded understanding, concentration on self-realization and God-realization. So that's the astonishing thing here, that, you know, there must have been something quite significant that Vidura would actually leave that circumstance in which Krishna was personally present often. Especially Krishna, you know, identifying that house as his own home. But that okay. Now, after, you know, some of the questions about the conversation between Vidura and Maitreya, in verses 6 to 13, Sukadeva Goswami will actually describe the events leading up to Vidura's departure from the palace of Hastinapur. Now, in summary, Maharaj Yudhisthira, requested the return of his rightful share of the kingdom, having returned from exile in the forest. So they were in exile for, was it 13 years? Yep. Dhritarashtra requested Vidura for his opinion, and Vidura recommended that Yudhisthira's legitimate share to the kingdom be returned to him, and that Duryodhana be expelled. Very strong words, of course, these things have been suggested. Although it seems quite strong, we have to understand that so many people have said the same thing. Srila Vyasadeva said the same thing. I think Markandeya Rishi, you know. There's so many saints and sages and advisors had actually said the same thing from the very birth of Duryodhana, because of, you know, such, you know, the inauspiciousness from the very beginning of his life. Why were they exiled? Why were the Pandavas exiled? They lost the gambling match. They were cheated in gambling by Duryodhana and his cohorts. Now, when they returned, Yudhisthira suggested that perhaps if they could give them, the five Pandavas, being Kshatriyas, even one village each, one little village. And as Prabhupada states in his lecture, that Duryodhana refused, and of course Dhritarashtra, being the king, then, you know, gave the final decree that they would not give them so much land as you could stick the pin of a needle into, you know, the point of a needle. We know that Krishna himself personally went to see if he could persuade them to avert war by just, again, Yudhisthira's asked for, you know, five villages. Surely that's not too much. Krishna, he personally went there. Dhritarashtra called for Vidura's advice. Vidura gave his advice, of course, which is that he should give the land back. He also explained to him that if he didn't, Bhima would kill each of his 100 sons, and the better he returned his the legitimate share of the kingdom. So verse 6 describes, of course, that Dhritarashtra was blind from birth, now some of these verses are quite interesting in they give a some insight into the nature of piety and impiety and how it actually can be favourable, unfavourable for helping one come to the point of advancement in spiritual life. Now here in the sixth verse, Srila Prabhupada mentions that Dhritarashtra, you know, he was physically blind, but his blindness in committing impious activities to support his dishonest sons was a greater blindness than the physical lack of eyesight. You know, physical lack of eyesight won't hinder one's spiritual progress, but when one is blind spiritually, and of course that is symptomized by that willingness to perform impious activities, that sort of blindness is dangerously detrimental to the progressive path of human life. One cannot advance at all. One can only descend, you know, with that attitude of impiety. That means someone is performing acts which are impious, sinful, they're being a complete rascal, and then they just close their eyes to the matter and they don't want to look any further, and they somehow think that that's the end of it. And because they're not going to acknowledge that there'll be any repercussions from that, they close their eyes to that, they believe that, well, that everything's finished. So that sort of blindness is very dangerous. And of course, you know, we understand that, you know, in this day and age, of course, you know, that sort of mentality is rife, you know, with intoxication, illicit sex, abortion, slaughterhouses, gambling. You know, people are quite happy to just act very, very sinfully, very impiously, and then just close their eyes to the repercussions of that. People who do that, of course, there is no possibility of spiritual advancement. Prabhupada gives an interesting in one of his lectures, he just describes the you know, he gives a warning to devotees, but he uses, you know, that devotees should, you know, not commit sinful activities and chant Hare Krishna. But as an example, he didn't want us to become like the Christians, where on Sunday you go to church and you repent, you know, you do confession. What he calls a Sunday-Monday business. Sunday, confession. Monday, you begin the same activities. Now, he explained, you know, of course, they close their eyes to the fact that there, you know, that there'll be any repercussions. I've done the confession. Now I'm sinful again. I don't have to look at that, you know. But if they did look, then this is the result. Prabhupada says, if they go to confession on the Sunday, then they become purified from the reactions of the sinful to some degree. On Monday, they commit the sins. If they die on Tuesday, they go to hell. Because they're sinful. So they haven't got to that confession for those sins.
Like they know they're
going to
die,
yeah.
But there's no like life after death.
That's the same mentality. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Everyone knows they're going to die.
That's right.
But that's it. They say, "Oh no, this is my life here and now."
That's right.
I'm just going to live
yeah.
here and now.
Yes.
Because there's nothing after that.
They're hoping there's nothing.
But they believe it.
That's right. They've so talked themselves into it. Yes. Yeah. That's right. They do. Yeah. Yeah.
There's nothing.
Yeah. And they don't want to look at the fact that there's something, because then they may be responsible for a lot of, you know, repercussions.
So can you say to them they're spiritually blind?
Oh yes, it is spiritual blindness. That's right. It's the owl mentality, or the ostrich in the image. Yeah.
I heard from somebody that actually this confession is working only if they promise basically that they will not do it again.
Yes, that's right.
Even if they promise that they do it,
yes,
and they do it again, it seems like they didn't get
the then decision. That's right, yeah. So that's another point to it, yeah. Now, you know, and you can also apply that to the devotees. Now, we know in the Nectar Devotion, when we studied the Bhakti Shastri, that you know, those who see the Rathayatra card of Lord Jagannath, they're considered to be liberated. So Prabhupada, in the same lecture, brought that in. That yes, you see Jagannath card, so you get liberated, means free from your sinful reactions. But if that person again goes and commits sinful activities, then they fall from that liberated platform. But people read those statements in the scriptures and think, I saw Jagannath's festival, I'm liberated for this whole lifetime. No. And then he gives an example. It's like, if you, you know, is there any hospitals, and they advertise, you come and visit here, whatever illness you've got, and you just a visit, and then you leave, and you'll be cured. You know, no, you go to the hospital, you stay until the disease is gone. They give you a plan for when you leave, so it doesn't come back. So this, and he also gives the example of people coming to the temple. You know, you can come, and yes, you can be liberated imperceptibly. But if you actually then leave and go back to you can fall back down to the platform of engaging in pious activities, and thereby are subjected to the reactions of those simple activities after leaving the temple. So, you know, in many, many different ways this, you know, applies. So, so as we go through these verses, we see that, you know, the king, Dhritarashtra, did not forbid his son Dushyant's abominable action of grabbing the hair of Draupadi at that. In verse 8, a Yudhisthira was born without an enemy. He was unfairly defeated in gambling. Right, but because he made a promise, he went to the forest, he kept his bargain, even though he was cheated. And when he came back, he asked for his rightful share. And he was refused by Dhritarashtra. And in verse 9, we see that Lord Krishna was sent by Arjuna into the assembly. And the king, Dhritarashtra or Duryodhana, did not take the words of Krishna very seriously either. Now, here again, we take up this subject matter of piety in the purport that, as Prabhupada says, that is the way of persons who have no credit of pious deeds. Now, by pious deeds, one may become the king. But because their pious the results of their pious acts were dwindling, right, then it became evident they were going to lose their kingdom. So you gain your kingdom through piety, and then it looks like that thing that you've gained, it's difficult to hang on to. It means that the pious results are running out, and one can no longer hang on to it. So Krishna, of course, spoke to Duryodhana, to everyone there, but his words were like very bitter, like poison to some, and to others they were like nectar to the devotees. So there's that nice analogy in that. So if we were to ask, going back to verse 8, what is the incident which actually caused the war of Kurukshetra? This is one of the homework questions. Who would like to answer? What is the incident? Describe the incident which actually caused the war of Kurukshetra. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's right. Prabhupada says in the purport that they demanded only five villages, one for each of the five brothers, and that was also refused by the usurpers. And that incident led to the war.
Can I make a comment?
Yep.
There's kind of a parallel where Yudhisthira is the complete opposite. And he took an oath, even though unfairly was cheated, and he still went to the forest. And he, well, you're talking about piety, he's gaining piety because he's actually behaving in the correct manner.
Yes.
So as all this is happening, working up to him actually getting back the kingdom because of the piety he's getting.
That's a good point. He's actually accruing piety constantly, yes. and therefore, that's a good indication that he will gain the kingdom. That's right. Mm.
Can this also be said that basically, even though you're in terms of Draupadi being insulted, since earlier we have read that that time Krishna did not punish when Draupadi was insulted because he wanted his devotee to get the credit.
That's right, yep. Yep.
So even that is, can you say that is also the
yep.
reason for the war. So all those reasons are there.
Yep. And the only thing is, one, the question asks us to answer the question from verse number 8. But if you were to ask the question generally, it may be more correct to say, describe the incident which was the last straw that caused the war. You might, you know. So, yeah, so that's a fact. Those other incidences were definitely main factors in causing the war. So this is like a last straw incident which is mentioned in this verse of, verse number 8. Yep. And therefore, in summary, if we take all of the different events then and summarize that, what does Prabhupada say in this purport as a conclusive statement as what caused the war? Yes, so that was the last straw. So then if we take everything, what would we say caused the war?
Basically, King Yudhisthira was Maharajudhisthira was the rightful heir of the whole kingdom.
Yep.
And he was accused that by Dhritarashtra in favor of his sons. That's basically
what I'm saying. Alright, let me put it this way. Who caused the war? The coups, yeah. So ultimately, that's the conclusive statement, right? Prabhupada does it. The battle of Kurukshetra, therefore, was induced by the Kurus and not the Pandavas. So yes, that would be the last incident, is, you know, that led to the war, not getting the five villages. And the yes, but if we say that what caused the Kurukshetra war, you can just say the Kurus caused it. That includes everything. And I think that's the point that Nirmala was coming to. Right? Is that right? He was absorbed in samadhi. Alright, so that would be the statement that you'd take from the battle of Kurukshetra, therefore, was induced by the Kurus and not the Pandavas. That's a real conclusive statement. Now, okay, so Vidura gives his advice, tells Yudhisthira you should return the kingdom. His rightful share of the kingdom. warns him about, you know, the mighty Bhima and the revenge that's coming if he doesn't do so. And in verse 12, we see here that, Lord Krishna, he has accepted these Pandavas. All the kings of the world are with Krishna. All the Yadus are with Krishna. Those Yadus and Krishna have conquered unlimited number of rulers. So one of the homework questions, of course, was what reasons does Vidura give for A, returning the legitimate share of the kingdom to the Pandavas? So from verse 12, what reasons does Vidura give, first of all, for returning the legitimate share of the kingdom of the Pandavas? Yep, Lord Krishna was intimate related with them as their cousin, yes. Yes, and the point being that Krishna they were supported by Lord Krishna, who possesses this universal power. So, yes, that is the main reason there. And of course we can also, we can add generally that Lord Krishna and his family members, because Krishna, his family members were all very, very powerful, like Krishna as well. They'd conquered all the kings of the world. And what about what reasons does Vidura give for expelling Duryodhana? Yeah, basically he's maintaining a non-devotee of Krishna. Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, so it does state, he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that's stated in the text.
So
the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the possessor of universal power, how can you defeat him? Yes. Especially his intimate related as their cousin. Now, some other interesting points about expelling Duryodhana is that, as Prabhupada mentions in the purport, so he's maintaining a non-devotee. Now, how does that equate to Dhritarashtra? Basically, a son, the very word putra means one who delivers you, he who delivers you from hell. When one dies, the son performs the Shraddha ceremony to ensure that one is delivered. Putra. Tra, to deliver. Put means hell. Something like that. I think that's the way it is. Deliver one from hell. Now, if Dhritarashtra dies, how is it that Duryodhana, who's an enemy of Vishnu, can perform a ceremony to please Vishnu to deliver his father? And it's just like that. So. Therefore, he's useless. I think the example is given like the eyes. Duryodhana was exactly like blind, troubling eyes, and sometimes they have to be removed. They're not giving any benefit, so sometimes the eyes may not give any benefit, so they can be kept. But if the eyes are not giving benefit and they're causing immense trouble, which is very dangerous to the body as a whole, then they actually have to be taken out. So Duryodhana's position was like this. He was causing blindness for his father and trouble. So in that, that's the example. So therefore needed to be removed. You know, very difficult, but sometimes, you know, no one wants to take their eyes out, but sometimes if they're useless and causing immense trouble, it has to be done. The Duryodhana's position was like that. And, you know, that is because, so, one, because he was an enemy of Vishnu, he was useless, he could not deliver his father. And because he was, you know, an enemy and a non-devotee, he was also causing a lot of trouble. So therefore, if we answer the next question is, why does Vidura call Duryodhana offence personified? Because he's envious of Lord Krishna. He's envious, he's inimical, faithless. Prabhupada uses all those words. They all summed up in the word envious, sums up all of those. Enemy, inimical, faithless. And Prabhupada says, you know, Dhritarashtra is wrongly maintaining such a personified offence under the mistaken impression that Duryodhana was a good son, able to liberate his father. Now, a little summary of verses 14 to 16. Hearing Vidura's advice, Duryodhana angrily responded by insulting Vidura and ordering him to be thrown out of the palace. Hearing Duryodhana's insulting words, Vidura placed his bow on the door and left his brother's palace. And Prabhupada gives the analogy. I did hear a lecture where Prabhupada said this actually happened. That it is said that giving good counsel to a foolish person causes a fool to become angry, just as feeding milk to a snake only increases its venomous poison. You know, so someone brought a snake into the home. It was thinking, nice snake, I'll give you milk and bananas, we'll be friends. And all it did was just increase his venom. And then because the snake is envious by nature, he one day bit him and killed him. And just making the snake more and more strong, powerful, like that. Very, very good lesson. It is... what's that saying? It's folly to be wise in a fool's paradise. That's the saying, Prabhupada. It's folly to be wise in a fool's paradise.
When you're really enjoying, how can you be wise?
No, folly means it's stupid, it's foolish. If you're seen as the wise person in a society of fools, you're in great danger. You're placing yourself in great peril. You will only come to great harm. My father used to always say to me that sometimes, you know, it's a wise man who can play the fool. And sometimes you know, a wise person actually has to be, you know, well, in the terms they use these days, you have to dumb yourself down a bit. You heard that phrase? That you dumb yourself down? Sometimes you've got to do that. Dumb yourself down a bit because of the association you're in. So, now, let's have a look at some of these harsh words by Jerudan. We see in Jerudan, his lips are trembling. He says, who asked him to come here, this son of a kept mistress? He is so crooked that he spies in the interest of the enemy against those whose support he has grown up. Toss him out of the palace immediately and leave him with only his breath. Of course, that, you know, leave him with only his breath means that they want to cane him within an inch of his life. That's that saying. Basically, cane him, take the skin off his body. A similar thing to what they did to Jesus. So you know, Vidura was in a similar position to, you know, Lord Jesus Christ. Now, Dasyputras, of course, Dasyputras there, you know, in Vedic culture, the kings, not others, but the kings, because they could maintain their wife and many others. Sometimes the wife had different maid servants, and sometimes the king would actually have children through those maid servants, and the children were called Dasyputras. They had no claim to the royal position. So, you know, in effect, Jerudan saying that, you know, he's inauspicious, being the son of a maid servant, and he's more inauspicious because of his activities as well, you know, being an infidel, or, you know, so as Prabhupada points out, you know, these are the very the intricacies of diplomacy. Even a faultless person like Vidura could be charged with something abominable and punished, you know. As Chanakya Pandit says, never trust a politician. Very dangerous circle to be in. So Sukadeva Goswami goes on to describe Vidura's travel. Now, verse 16, Vidura's reaction, we're going to come back and have a look at that, because it's interesting how Vidura, he places his bow at the door and he quit his brother's palace. He was not sorry though, for he considered the acts of the external energy to be supreme. We'll come back and have a look at that statement, how he saw both the external energy and the working with regard to Jerudan and Dhritarashtra, but the internal energy acting literally to give him another opportunity on the spiritual path. So we'll come back and look at that later. But just move on to have a look at Vidura's travels on pilgrimage in verses 17. So he went on pilgrimage after leaving Hastinapur, and with a desire to gain a high order of pious life, he travelled to holy places where thousands of transcendental forms of the Lord are situated. So this is, one of the last verses we'll look at in connection to the conversation we're having about piety. Now here, Vidura is considered to be a highly elevated and pious soul. So we've looked at the reverse. The impious souls, here Vidura, very highly elevated pious soul. You know, he basically, actually, his birth in the Kaurava family, although even though he was the son of a maidservant, any birth in that Kaurava family was very high. The statement was, a malicious statement by Duryodhana, which very slanted by envy. Now, the interesting thing here, Prabhupada mentions that, but such pious possessions, the results of piety, sort of good birth, wealth, learning, beauty, they're not sufficient for obtaining the grace of the Lord and being engaged in His transcendental loving service. The Vidura considered himself less pious, and therefore he decided to travel to all the great places of pilgrimage in the world in order to achieve greater piety and advance nearer to the Lord. Vidura was conscious that by his association of the diplomatic Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana, he'd actually lost his piety and was therefore not fit to associate at once with the Lord. Lost his piety means, in one sense, that just very little opportunity for devotional service. We know that sometimes members of the Hare Krishna movement, if they're living in certain circumstances, sometimes it's with friends, colleagues, or what have you, or other students, that they find that there is no opportunity to gain any real piety because there's no real discussions about transcendental subject matters, there's no endeavours to control the mind and the senses or deity worship or anything really pious. So literally in the association he had, it was a desert for that sort of activity. And at the same time, by association, sometimes you become implicated in other, accepting a little bit of the reaction to other people's activities which are not so good. So, he sort of felt that, in essence, that it was holding him back from really being able to become properly fit to associate with the Supreme Lord. Even a saintly person like Vidura. So it's therefore devotees can also should take careful note that who we associate with, who we live with, who we work with. Even as devotees, we have to be careful that we don't somehow become implicated or held back in our spiritual progress by that. We have to be a little careful. So he wanted to go on pilgrimage to, become fit, cleanse himself of all that, and to accumulate, the piety. Accumulate piety, means that... by controlling the mind and the senses and fixing, one's heart upon the Supreme Lord, performing austerities, ridding one's life of anything unnecessary for the spiritual path. Okay. In the same purport, what are some of the facilities? This is one of the homework questions you get. Well, let's ask this question. Actually, we just answered that question. Why didn't Vidura approach Krishna directly? We just answered that. Yeah, he was not fit to associate at once with the Lord. He felt that he'd become less pious due to that association, and he wanted to become more pious through pilgrimage. Which leads us to the next homework question. You know, identify some of the facilities offered by holy places of pilgrimage, as mentioned in verses 17 and 45. Who'd like to point out some of those? Yep. So the Lord is present in all his different transcendental forms, so people can associate with the Lord. Yep. Yes, yes. Places of pilgrimage are meant for eradicating the sins of the pilgrims. So if one has accumulated impiety, you go there, and actually pilgrims go there and leave their impious reactions in those holy places, and the devotees come through and purify the places of pilgrimage. Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. So that is Vidura consciously wanted to do that, and that is one of the benefits of one of the facilities offered by the holy place. Yeah. What else? Yep. Meet the great souls who are engaged in the service of the Lord. One of the most important aspects, we know. If that's not done, actually, you know, visiting holy places of pilgrimage yields very little benefit. what else can we say? Yes, even visiting a temple. If you come to a temple, you go anywhere and you don't actually, you know, associate with the devotees, so for instance, people may come in, drop a bag of rice on the deity's altar and go away. So, you know, they've made some, by that, imperceptibly, they've become liberated from so much impious reactions. But because they're not associated with the devotees, they'll go out and do the same thing again, the same impious activities. But if they associate with the devotees, when they leave here, they'll actually be inclined not to do that, and they'll be inclined to actually perform devotional service. That's the difference. If you go to a samadhi and remember their instructions, then you're associating properly. But, you know, so you can remember or you can hear and discuss, but to not remember or hear the instructions of the devotees is what was talking about, is not getting the significant benefit from holy places. So if you go to the holy places and even remember, that's practically the same. Devotional service is absolute. Actually, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam, if it's done properly, each one is non-different from the other. If you're remembering the instructions of the devotees, that means you're hearing their instructions, non-different. But if you're doing neither, then you're absolutely doing nothing. All right? What about verse 45? Yes, yes, yeah. That opportunity to hear the glories of the Lord. Yes. So we can see, you know, the deity forms are there, and we can, you know, offer something in charity, and if we can meet the great souls and they're engaged in devotional service, and you know, we can hear something about the glories of the Lord. So that's also very nice. Because as Prabhupada mentions, that as he says in verse 45, that the purpose of pilgrimages is to remember the Lord constantly. Yeah, to remember the Lord, remember the Lord's instructions, or to remember the Lord's instructions coming through the Vaishnava, which means to remember the Vaishnava's instructions. But to remember, that's the very purpose of pilgrimages. So we can hear and chant while we're there in the association of devotees. If there are no devotees present, we can remember the instructions of the Lord, either coming from the Bhagavad Gita, from the Bhagavatam, or what we may have heard from sadhus previously. I know when I went to Vrindavan many years ago, I used to just read the Krishna book constantly. I'd start, you know, from the day I left here, all the way to the airport, on the plane, all the way through Vrindavan, all the way till I got back, and pretty much, you know, I'd read the entire Krishna book. So, just my whole, you know, travels for the Dharma was just trying to remember Krishna. So I'd read the entire 90 chapters of the Krishna book by the time I got back. The interesting thing here is that, you know, in that verse, at the very end of this chapter, that Vidura says to Uddhava, you know, my friend, please chant the glories of the Lord, who is meant to be glorified in the places of pilgrimage. He refers to Krishna as being Tirthapad, and another way of saying that is that Krishna is himself the best place of pilgrimage. He is Tirthapad. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur paraphrases that. He says, you know, Vidura says, I have bathed in almost all the holy places. Now, bathe me in the nectar of the famous place called Krishna, which will make all the other holy places successful. Okay. Yep. So the deities are there, of course. In verse 18, Prabhupada, you know, points out that the Sanskrit Ananta Linga, that these deity forms have unlimited potency, the same as the Lord himself. He gives a nice analogy of the letter boxes, the post boxes, that they're authorized, right? With the function of carrying letters. And the Archimurti can also deliver the same unlimited potency of the Lord as when he is personally present. There's a nice statement that, you know, when we see the deities of the Lord, we don't think that it's any, you know, we see Radhavala, we don't think that, oh, it's, you know, well, at least we have the deities, we shouldn't think at least, you know, it's actually the same unlimited potency as when Krishna is personally present. That's what Anantalinga. Now, he travels through many different holy places, and at the place of Prabhasa, it comes to his knowledge that all his relatives have died due to violent passion, just as an entire forest burns due to fire produced by the friction of bamboos. I think he travelled for about 30 to 35 years. Now, okay. This, let's have a look at these verses. So he's performing the pilgrim's progress, as Prabhupada calls it. Now, so at Prabhasa Setra, at that time Maharaj Yudhisthira was the emperor and held the world under one military strength and one flag. So at this stage we understand that the Battle of Kurukshetra, of course, has been completed. Of course, that would have been, that would have been fought not long after Vidura left. And we know that Amara Yudhisthira ruled for about 30-35 years, like that, didn't he? And then they retired. So Maharaj Yudhisthira was the emperor and held the world under one military strength and one flag. Mm. So at that place, in verse 21, it came to his knowledge that all his relatives had died due to violent passion. The example is given of the bamboos. Bamboo forest. So therefore he proceeded west, where, along the river Sarasvati, another 11 significant places of pilgrimage, and then gradually came to the banks of the Jamuna, where he happened to meet Uddhava, the great devotee of Lord Krishna. Okay. This meeting with Vidura and Uddhava . This is the second time that Uddhava went to meet Krishna, because for those who have studied the 11th canto, Uddhava heard, there was all the inauspicious omens, and there was, indicating something was going to happen with regard to the Yadu dynasty. Uddhava had overheard Krishna and understood that he was leaving this world. He wanted Krishna to take him back to the spiritual world with him. But Krishna wanted Uddhava, who was, practically the most qualified person, to remain and, spread the teachings, especially the confidential teachings, because we know that Uddhava had actually visited the gopis and all the residents of Vrindavan. So he'd been educated in very, very, first-hand, most elevated understanding of Prema Bhakti. Krishna wanted to send him to Bhadarikashram, where many Naranarayana Rishi and many other great sages could be, hear the discussions from Uddhava. on his way there, feeling separation from the Lord, he actually turned back and went back to where he found, he came across the scene just after the annihilation of the Yadu dynasty, and Krishna was sitting. It was just before the departure of Krishna, when he was shot in the foot by a hunter, and Krishna gave Uddhava he told him all the events that had unfolded and gave him further instructions. Then there was Krishna's departure from this world. Now I believe when Krishna was speaking, Maitreya also arrived. And it was after Krishna's departure that Vidura comes upon Uddhava. And that's where we're taking up here. Alright, so he's seen many of the different temples of the Lord. Just before we discuss this point a little bit more, just discussing a little bit about the temples of the Lord, one of the homework questions: explain the significance of the Lord's chakra. Who would like to give a couple of sentences explaining that? Yes. Yes. Yeah. The chakra is a symbol of power by which the Lord controls the whole material manifestation, and it is particularly significant because amongst the four emblems, the chakra is the chief one. So that's So both are correct. And it's also placed on top of the various temples so that people can see the temples from a long way away and oh, there's the temple, you know, we should go there and, you know, like that. And they can immediately remember Krishna even if they're a long distance. So, certainly amongst all those different statements, we have to consider that the chakra is the chief amongst the four. That's probably the most important one to put. And the other two, you know, are significant points as well. But the fact that it's the chief amongst the four symbols is particularly significant. Okay. Now, again. So we see from verses 25 to 35, Vidura begins to inquire from Uddhava about the welfare of the Yadavas in Dwarka. Okay. Now, we have to remember that Vidura already knows about the fact that all of these different persons have actually left the planet. He heard about this when he went to Prabhashetra. Prabhashetra, of course, being the place. So he's heard, you know, no doubt, both about the... the Battle of Kurukshetra, and of course the annihilation of the Yadav dynasties. In one purport there, Prabhupada mentions that he has you see in verse 21, Prabhupada mentions in the purport that both the Kauravas and the Yadavas were relatives of Dura. And Vidura heard of their extinction due to the fratricidal war. Prabhupada does mention in the purport that to verse 25 that Jiva Goswami states that the news was shocking to Vidura, who therefore inquired again due to great curiosity. his inquiry is psychological and not practical. It's something that just really affected him, and therefore he's inquiring even though he already knows. Okay. Now, he does ask about personalities. We see there's a list of them. Suryasen, Vasudev, Prajumna, Rukmini, Ugrasen, Samba, Jambavati, Yuyadana, Krura, Deviki, Aniruddha, Hridika, Chattadeshna, Gada, Satyabhama, which in essence is the answer to, I think it's the final homework question, is list the members of the Yadu dynasty mentioned by Uddhava in verses 26 to 35. So he inquires about all those persons. Okay. Yeah. In verse 27, it describes the relationship Vidura has with Vasudev, Kunti, Pandu. It shows his relationship with the Pandavas there. Vasudev, that's Krishna's father, was the husband of Vidura's sister. Prabhupada says Rahini, the mother of Baladev, was the sister of Vidura. And then again, Vasudev's sister Kunti was the wife of Pandu, Vidura's elder brother. So in a couple of different ways, Vasudev is the brother-in-law of Vidura. Vasudev looked after Kunti. Like a father, in the sense that he had greater affection for Kunti, especially because she'd lost all her sons. Now, we hear about Prajumna. He says, tell me about Prajumna, the commander-in-chief, who was Cupid in his former life. Rukmini bore him as her son from Lord Krishna. Now you should understand that in the purport, Prabhupada does mention that Smara, Cupid or Kamadev, is one of the eternal associates of Lord Krishna. So actually this Prajumna, the son of Rukmini, is actually one of the Chaturvyuha. Aniruddha is also one of the Chaturvyuha. We had these are expansions. So Krishna expands. Krishna never leaves Vrindavan, but for his pastimes he expands as Vasudev. So Krishna of Mathura and Dwarka is Vasudev, Sankarshan, the Balaram of Dwarka, is Sankarshan, the first Adi Sankarshan, and Prajumna and Aniruddha, son and grandson. they're actually the Chaturvyuha. They're the personality of Godhead, non-different, equally powerful. Non-different from one another, although they perform different activities. We see that it describes in the verse that Prajumna is described as being Cupid in his former life. We also see in verse 30 that Kartikeya, born of Lord Shiva. In the purport to verse 30, Prabhupada says that the demigods of the heavenly kingdom appeared as associates of the Lord in the forms of Prajumna, Samba. Samba was Kartikeya. Uddhava. It is learned that Kamadev appeared as Prajumna, Kartikeya Samba, one of the Vasas as Uddhava, at this. So, yes. Yes.
It is, yes.
It is pastimes in order to fulfill Krishna's plan. But here you're getting two statements. One, you're getting the statement that these personalities, some of these personalities are demigods, and the other is you're getting the statement that some of these personalities are actually Vishnu Tattva. Both are true. So, Prajumna is in fact, Vishnu Tattva, and Iruda is Vishnu Tattva. And they, their amsas or empowered parts are these various demigods. So both are there. So for instance, if we take the example of Prajumna, where Prajumna is acting, in his capacity as Vishnu Tattva, then we see that Prajumna of the Vishnu Tattva is acting, and sometimes Prajumna acts in his capacity as Kamadev, the demigod, who is actually present along with the Vishnu Tattva Prema, Prajumna, in the same personality. So in other words, Kartikeya enters within Samba, Krishna's son. Prajumna, Kamadev, the demigod, enters within, Prajumna, the Vishnu Tattva, like this. So the demigods are present, and, at the end of the eternal pastimes, the Vishnu Tattva and the Nitya Siddha devotees go back to the spiritual world, and the demigod portions of that person actually returned to the heavenly planets. There are many different reasons why, you have to understand, of course, that these pastimes of the Lord are written both for persons who are, have a materialistic understanding. There are jnanis who have an impersonal understanding of the spiritual existence, and therefore, as a way of praise, when these personalities are described as being great demigods, for some persons it gives them some idea of the awesome power. But for persons who have no sense of the spiritual personalities than to, you know, say that Prajumna, the son of Krishna, Krishna Rukmini, is you know, the third expansion in the Chaturvyuha. What? You know, it's very difficult for them, you know, to understand. You mean there's form and there's personality in the spiritual world? Very, very difficult. So sometimes to praise these personalities just as demigods is helpful to understand. Oh, awesome, these are no ordinary personalities. You know, Arjun, who is Arjun? He's Indra. Oh, like this. But actually, you know, Arjun is an eternal associate of the Lord, and Indra also enters within that form with the eternal associate of the Lord to perform pastimes. But for ordinary persons who read the Mahabharata, oh, Arjun, oh, he is, you know, a portion of Indra, you know, son of Indra, like that. So for them, it is praise, great praise. But if you say, oh, he's an eternal, you know, has a spiritual, you know, eternal spiritual personality, and they're thinking, but there's nothing beyond material world, you know, or it's all impersonal, what are you talking, you know. So then how do you offer praise? So for many different reasons, you know, these things are stated in this way. But for our understanding, we should understand that these personalities are, you know, many of these personalities, you'll learn some of them are Nitya Siddhas, some of them are Vishnu Tattva, and some of them are demigods, you know, and some of them are both, like that. Because devotees understand, you see, in there is a question, 8 of the homework questions, list the three features of the Lord's internal potency from verse 31. So what are the three features of the Lord's internal potency? Sambit, Sandini, Ladini, yes. And Prabhupada mentions in that purport that in spite of their strict adherence to the various principles, the great yogis and jnanis are unable to enter into the internal potency of the Lord. You see? They can't understand anything of the spiritual nature of the Lord, these transcendental form of Satchitananda, you know. This internal potency is, however, easily realized by the devotees of the Lord by dint of devotional service. In verses 36 to 40, Vidura inquires from Uddhava about the welfare of the Pandavas. So he's asked about the Yadus. Now he begins to ask about the Pandavas. We notice in text 41 that he doesn't ask about Dhritarashtra, in essence, because there's no chance of his well-being, only news of his gliding down to hell. And Prabhupada mentions something of the character of Vidura or a devotee. Vidura never became an enemy of Dhritarashtra, but he continued to be his well-wisher. And we read in, was it the first canto, it was Vidura who actually helped Dhritarashtra to attain liberation, even though he was destined for hell. Such is the behaviour of Vaishnava like Vidura. And then verses 41 to 45, of course, Vidura describes also about the transcendental nature of the Lord's appearance, and finally requests Uddhava to chant the glories of the Lord. Vidura doesn't actually mention Duryodhana's name at all. Yeah. Let me see. I think this is the last question. There's a lot of homework questions in this one. Why, from verse 43, why did Lord Krishna not chastise the Kurus immediately after they insulted Draupadi in the assembly at Hastinapura? He wanted all those proud kings to come together to kill them all at once. Yeah, and and also another very important reason. He wanted Arjun to be the hero and take that credit. Yeah. Yes. which is. Yes, we're going to come to that one. We're going to come to that one. We're almost there. Now, Vidura, you know, his realizations of Krishna, as we see in verse 44 as well, that a lot of summary points here. He doesn't take birth like other living entities. Under the influence of the material nature and the bondage of reactions to past deeds. So Lord Krishna doesn't take birth due to karma, you know, under material bondage. And nor has he any desire to improve himself. But you know, by performing any activities in the material world. He's full of all opulence, all strength, all fame, all beauty. Why would he want to improve himself? Someone who has these qualities unlimitedly. So he's not forced to come, and he has no desire to come for any material reason. And, you know, why does he come? So that they can be relished, his activities can be relished. both by the Kamis, the Gyanis and the Bhaktas. so therefore, because he's transcendental to the laws of karma, he doesn't have a form of Maya as is forced on the ordinary living entities. So karma means you're forced into a material body. If you don't have karma, it means you don't have a material body. If you have a body, it's not a material body, it must be a Satchitananda body. Yeah, so that proves. The primary reason is, you know, to give people the opportunity to relish his pastimes, and the secondary purpose is to annihilate the upstart asuras and stop their nonsense atheistic propaganda. And if he personally kills them, they become liberated. So these all distinguish the Lord, you know, from ordinary living entities. These are some of Vidura's realization. Prabhupada sums them up in that purport, which you know, Vidura is speaking in those last few verses. And you know, which brings us to. Verse 16, we go back to that, which answers the question to question 4. Explain how Maya acted in Juridan's insulting Vidura, and both internally and externally. Now, just before we discuss verse 16, there is a link there with Vidura's statements in verse 42. In verse 42, he says, by the mercy, what is it? Says, now, in the previous verse, we heard how he's lamenting for Dhritarashtra. He rebelled against his brother after Pandu's death. And drove Vidura out of his house, you know, even though he was a sincere well-wish for Dhritarashtra. You know, like this. So, In the next verse he says, but I'm not surprised at this. And then he goes on to describe the activities of the Lord. They're bewildering to others, such as Dhritarashtra, but not to his devotees, such as Vidura. In other words, he's saying, by the mercy of the Lord, Vidura's been able to see the lotus feet of the Lord, which is hidden from the vision of ordinary people like Dhritarashtra. So he's, you know, in this way he's been able to wander the various holy places without any doubt, and that's why he's speaking these wonderful realizations about Krishna. So he's appreciating. Krishna covered Dhritarashtra, so he, you know, Krishna did not allow Dhritarashtra to understand Krishna's the nature of Krishna. He was hidden. But he allowed Vidura to understand. So, therefore, Vidura is not sorry at what happened. You know, Vidura actually wanted to achieve sincere devotional service and become a completely surrendered soul to Krishna. On that pilgrim's journey, he managed to do that. It was very rare, so he wasn't sorry that those things happened, because it allowed him to fulfill that great spiritual ambition, which is very difficult and very rare to achieve. He was not sorry that he didn't have a house and a home anymore, because he understood that dependence on the mercy of the Lord is a greater freedom than the so-called freedom at home. You know, generally living on the streets is considered, if we can get ourselves out of that situation, we're free from a lot of dangers and difficulties. We have a lot of liberties. But here he's saying, actually, but even greater than that is to be completely dependent upon the Lord. That's a greater freedom. Unlimitedly. So now that stage of dependency is called Sattva Samsudhi, purification. One's existence is purified to the point where he's only dependent upon the transcendental Lord, and if one comes to that stage, it will manifest in that fearlessness. So, you know, he's not sorry, he's not afraid, he's free from doubt. So those statements show that he is on that platform of fearlessness and complete purification, where he is completely dependent upon the Lord. Called Narayana Para, or Narayana Paraya. They're never afraid of anything. They're always aware of the fact that the Lord protects them in all circumstances. So many, you know, as Prabhupada says, that Krishna is always bewildering to the non-devotees, but he's always seen by the devotees by dint of their pure devotional service. So that was his realization. So now if we go back to verse 16 and we can answer that question, how did Maya act in Jiradhan's insulting Vidura, both internally and externally? Who would like to say something there?
He acted internally by allowing the Vidura to be free of his family problems so that he could follow transcendental life.
Yes, it acted as the internal energy. Yeah. The Maya acted as the internal energy, yes, to help him. That situation gave him that opportunity which he wanted to advance in his spiritual life. Yeah, and how did it act as the external energy?
Was it by the actions of Duryodhana? body's works, actions,
like it gave
that Krishna the external energy as well as the internal energy,
and
gave him the opportunity to
yes.
go on that samadhi.
Yes, so the external energy was acting on Jiva. And the internal energy was acting on Vidura, as Krishna, you know, the internal energy was giving Vidura the opportunity for spiritual advancement, and the external energy was acting on Duryodhana, who was making progress on the path of his own ruination, as Prabhupada puts it. So the external energy, we cannot make any spiritual progress, but we can become materially ruined under the clutches of the material energy. So that was acting on Duryodhana. The internal energy was actually acting on Vidura by giving him an opportunity. That was Krishna's grace, because everyone in this world, you know, has terrible material circumstances happen to them, but not everyone gets the prompt and the opportunity that at the same time that that happens, there is prompts from Krishna and his representatives and his books and what have you to push you on the spiritual path. Just like, you know, when Srila Prabhupada, when his business failed and his family was, you know, becoming somewhat disappointed in him and everything like that, he was, in his dreams, his spiritual master Srila Bhakti Siddhanta was calling him, come with me, take sannyas, like this. So that doesn't happen to everyone. You know, someone's house burned down, they don't have dreams, someone's called the spiritual master to come take sannyas, like this. You know, they have nightmares like that. And no, it's a fact. And no, that's right. Yes, because he saw that Krishna, with his internal energy, manifested himself to Vidura in the form of the opportunity to visit all the holy places, to be free from all distractions, to visit so many saintly persons, and also to come across Uddhava. I mean, fancy, you know, coming across Uddhava, you know, just, you know, of all the great devotees, you know, that's Krishna's internal energy. So, you know, the material energy causes so much ruination, but when that happens, if someone has Krishna is making opportunity that a devotee appears at that exact same time to give good instruction, or someone comes across one of Prabhupada's books at that time, you know, or you know, within one's heart, someone actually gets some, you know, specific inspiration, you know, like that. Then you see that the internal energy is acting like that. So that's what was happening to Vidura. Mm-hmm. All right. Vidura?
Was pure enough to hear the prompts of the Lord, because, I mean, they say that is it this lesson for us that during calamity we can try to see what Krishna has in it for us? Is there a lesson for us? That's what I'm trying to learn.
Yes, he did, otherwise he wouldn't have gone on pilgrimage.
It is not there for people who are not.
Yeah, he might have just gone to made another home for himself somewhere on the outskirts of Hastinapur.
No, that is true, but is there any lesson for us?
No, we do. There is a lesson. I'm just trying to think what it is. Sorry, I'm laughing at my own jokes. I shouldn't do that. But yes, in the case of Vidura, in the beginning, he didn't have full realization. And therefore, He wanted to purify himself, as described. He didn't actually think that he was properly fit to fully associate with Krishna, even though that opportunity may have been there, and to take his association. He went on pilgrimage, knowing that he had to come to a higher level of realization of what was going on in his life and why everything had happened. He had a sense of it that, yes, you know, here's an opportunity to become a devotee, a surrendered devotee to the Supreme Lord, and he followed that inspiration. But after his pilgrim's journey, he was completely convinced. He had no doubts left. He was completely fearless and he was completely dependent. So in the beginning he understood that yes, this is the direction, but after that pilgrim's progress and of course after meeting Uddhava, then he was completely convinced. So devotees are like that, that yes, sometimes things happen. We have some indication that we should go with Krishna and his devotees in this way. And then after, you know, realization through devotional service and surrender, a devotee become completely convinced absolutely, you know, no doubt and completely fearless, at Krishna's lotus feet.
No, my question is, for a devotee, or we can't try to think along those lines. Because we say,
no, we should.
Anything good or bad happening to you, it is actually Krishna's mercy. That's what we normally say.
Yeah, we should always try and see, you know, Krishna's indication. We should try to do that.
But sometimes you don't see it till after you've recovered from it.
That's a fact. That's a fact.
Attitude. If you say something, that is there a lesson for me? Is it the attitude from trying to see when the help is there? Okay, we may not understand it, but is there a lesson for me? Is there something in it?
Yes, we should think like that.
Oh,
there's a lesson. Yeah, where the lesson is there, we should think, what is the lesson? Yeah. When things happen, we should definitely take, you know, that example of Madhura. You know, things happen for a reason, especially to devotees, because Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 10th chapter, that to those who are constantly engaged in my devotional service, I give them intelligence from within. So Krishna says that he's doing that. So the more we engage in Krishna's service, the more he gives us that direction. So if we're engaging in devotional service and Krishna is giving that direction, we should try and understand what that direction is. Okay. All right, so that covers chapter 1. Now I'm going to hand it over to the class for chapter 2. Now just before we do, just while everyone's here, I'm going to, this morning we discussed, and I'll just give you those dates for everyone who wasn't there. We're coming up to class presentation.
Earlier.
What's that? Earlier, that's right. Losing track of time. Yeah. Losing track of material time. Alright. Next Saturday we're doing lesson 5. Today we're doing lesson 4 of unit 7. Next Saturday, the 23rd, we're doing lesson 5. And you may want to jot those down. Some of them have already and others should if they haven't. Lesson 5 will cover the next 2 chapters. We're going to go over some of the main things, but then most of the work will be done by the class themselves. Now, the following week, we're going to have the exam for Unit 7, the closed book exam, at 2 o'clock. Because, you know, from 3 o'clock, you're going to begin, continue with your group class presentations. We're going to start them today, and after the exam on the 30th, right, 2 weeks' time, you'll have a few hours, and in your groups, you'll finalise some of the things. And then the following week, on the 6th of August, you'll actually do that presentation where your group will do a half hour presentation. Half hour is a long time when you're in front of an audience. Let me say that again. Yeah. The first time I ever gave class as a brahmacharya, they gave me my 45 minutes. I think I got to about the 5 minute mark, and I was done. I had nothing. Everything that I'd had to say, I'd said it, and then I sat there and I just, what do I do now? I've got 40 minutes to go. And the class ended, after another 2 or 3 minutes. I had, that was it. So, half an hour like that, and you think, it's easy, but it's not. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 minutes. And you will be marked on the timing.
Oh,
the timing. Oh, yes. Yeah. So if you seriously go over time, or considerably under time, it's significant marks are deducted.
Ideally, what is the time you're looking
half an hour.
Is 5 minutes.
We'll go over that in a second. I will get to that. All right. So that'll be on the 6th of August. So let's just have a quick look at that now, and then what we're going to do is I'm going to assign a few of the topics of chapter 2 to different groups, and you can do a little 5 minute presentation just off the cuff. Alright? So, alright. Let's, while I'm just pulling out some notes, you can just all sign the attendance sheet. Now, if you know anyone that's not here, it's quite important that they who's just have a look on that list, just see who's not here in this class, and because what we need to do is over the next couple of weeks, it's quite important that everyone comes along, because if we can't do these again, so in other words, if we do a group presentation and then one or two people later on, come along, they basically can't get marked. That's part of, it's quite strict the way they set this out. So, if someone's not here, they basically just don't get a mark for that unit. And they would have to wait till the next time we do it. So it's quite important that, the students try and, get in amongst the group. And if they somehow miss a class, they have to work with someone out of class, activities, and try and be there on the day.
The whole group will do the presentation, or one of
the whole group does the presentation? Well, not necessarily, but pick the person very carefully, because each student gets that person's same mark. Right. Yeah.
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 Is there a criteria that all the people are involved? Is that a criteria?
Yes.
The criteria is that all the people have
to. Yeah. Let's get to that. I'll show you some. Okay. Now. How this works is that we're doing Unit 7. Next week is the last lesson on Unit 7. So each unit has 5 lessons. Next week is lesson 5. Then we're going to do the closed book test. That means for lesson 7, we've done the closed book test. The essays that you usually hand in, you only have to do the first 2 questions to hand in for unit 7, and the other 2 questions for unit 7 become the whole project for unit 8. That's all you have to do for the whole of unit 8. There's no closed book exam, there's no essays. So the last 2 questions of unit 7, those open book essay questions, is what you'll actually be doing your presentation on, and that is unit 8. It's a half an hour presentation. Alright, so they're from chapters 3 and 4 of the third canto.
3 and
4? Yeah.
And the first 2 are from chapter 9, I think.
Yeah, so the first question that we've already done, we did that in canto 2. The second question about Mayavada something, apparatus something, we're going to do that next week. But the last 2 questions, 3 and 4, you'll be doing as a half an hour presentation. And that half an hour presentation is everything you have to do for Unit 8. So as you can see, it carries a lot of weight because there's no there's no other marking for Unit 8. All your marking will be that one presentation. You know, in other units you get marked for your closed book tests and your essays. If you lose on one, you pick up on the other. Here you've only got the one chance. You'll be marked both by me. I will be given 60% of the mark, and your peers will be giving 40%. The peers. So everyone has to be here. How many people we got? 3, 4. Let's say about 16 people. Half an hour each, it's 2 hours. What's that?
Unit 8 is group presentation.
Group
presentation? Yeah,
Unit 8. Yeah, it is Unit 8, but Unit 8 uses the last 2 questions of Unit 7. So all of that, yes, for instance, if you go into your student handbooks, you'll see that on page 114, it says Unit 8, see facilitator, that's me, for presentation schedule. Now where it says Canto 3, chapters 5 to 12, that's not quite correct. That's actually for the next unit. Alright, you understand that? I think the numbering the numbering of the units after that, I'll have to correct these books because the numbering of the units is always, saying one more than what it is. You see what I mean? Because really, Unit 9 should be on the title on page 114, Chapters 5 to 12 is actually Unit 9. Yeah. I sort of edit these books as I go through them, and I did notice the other day that this needs to be tidied up a little bit. We're going to do 30 minutes. Yes, they're correct, yes. Yeah. So everyone understand that basically on 114, you know, it really should also say there, just above, you know, Canto 3, Chapter 5, that is starting Unit 9. Yeah, it starts at chapter 5, unit 9 starts there. So, next time I print these books, I'm going to take these things from page 128, the group presentations, and I'm going to put them back here around about page, 114. That's where they should be. And then, but the information you need there to understand that, yes, from page 128, it does give you the presentation guidelines, how you'll be marked. 60% from the facilitator, 40% from the peers. Absentees will not be awarded a grade. That's their strict terms. Penalty 5% may be deducted, so there's a little bit of leeway there. Starting and finishing presentation, that's at the discretion of the facilitator. I've heard he's a very hard man, But it's the peers you want to watch out for. So you see 30% for understanding, 15% for personal application, 20% for preaching and theological, 15% for mood and mission, 20% for Shastra Chakshu. Now, keep in mind that these essay questions are preaching application questions. All right? If you look at what page we're on, 112. We see that one is a preaching application, number 3, and number 4 is a mood and mission. So, preaching application gets 20%, mood and mission here gets 15%. Now, my understanding from the way they've set this up is that you have to actually present something on each of these categories to get marks. So that if it's, although it's a preaching application, you still have to somehow present material to get your 15% quota of marks with some mood and mission content in your presentation. Yep.
It should have something about mood and mission as well.
Yep, and personal application.
And
Shastra Chakshu. Right? And it should be something that's easily understood. You'll only get one question. You'll only get one question per group to do. Each group will do one of those questions. So, you know, if we have 4 groups, for example, 2 will be doing one question 3 and 2 will be doing question 4. Yes, so that's there. Now, what we can do is we might get do a lucky dip. So we will cover a little bit of this subject matter next week. Well, the problem is that if I follow your line of thought, you may choose the wrong question, thinking that's the easy one and end up with a hard one. Therefore, I'll choose for you. But therefore, we'll do the lucky dip method. I would say we've got about, let me see. I think we can only fit in four at the most, because I'd like to just do them on the one day. I think we'll get four groups because four groups makes it that everyone's got to do something. If you had two bigger groups, there's going to be people doing nothing. Okay. Shuffle them up. We're going to need four people to choose on behalf of the four groups. Let's divide up into four groups first. Four groups. Let's divide into four groups. Should we do that by? We've got to, perhaps those who think that they, you know, can, because you've got basically 2 weeks to do this, and you've got, you know, so you want to be able to work with people that you're going to see. Out of class. On the 6th of August. Okay. Yep. It is 3 weeks from now. You're not in? Okay. All right. Alright, so we got to find out who was not on that list that should be here. Did my pen go around with that, or? Have you got? Can you write down who's not on that list? Who's not here today? Who's on that list? Who's not here today that we need to contact? Okay, four groups. Group leader? All right, we've got one. No? All right, one group leader. Another one? About four. I think there's about 16. How many names altogether? About? I think we'll do four groups. 18, because we've only got time in the one day to do four. The half an hour each, that's 2 hours with just a little bit to start and in between. Alright, so we've got one. Another group leader. Okay, so we've got two hands there. We've got these two, Bhakti Sara and Gopi Brindesh. We both had the hands up. That's right, we need one more. Be careful. You do want to go together. You're in different groups. You'll be seeing each other? Okay, alright. So yourself, Amit. Okay, let's write these down. Someone write these names up on the board. They're the people not here. Someone write these names up on the board just for. Okay. Okay, we've got group one. Gopa, Bhakti Sara, Amit, and who else? One more? No, you need one more. Yeah. Yep. Let's go. All right. Who's in your group? What's that? Yeah. Yourself? Hang on, I'll just get a pen. Who else? Who's that? Who's okay. Okay. Who is number four? Okay, we'll get it. We'll throw another one in there. Who are you with, Nanda? What happened there?
Nanda Mandir, myself.
Oh, well, you can't do that. You have to be group three. The three is a lucky number. So we got.
I think Prabhu, Gopa and Bhaktis. Bhaktis and Prabhu has to be split
up. You got that.
Both are scholars.
Okay. Two L's?
I think.
Two L's in Bailey? No, two L's, that's your name. Vana, yeah. You must know how to spell your name. Okay. No, that's alright. Who haven't we got here? Yeah, best guy was here. What's that?
One, two.
Okay, then we have. What did I do with that list? Okay. Now, we've got Amit, so Amit's there. Smriti. Huh? Yeah. So and Chandra Vallabhi. I think she. Yeah. Let me see. I think I have a feeling that she's actually done up to third canto. She's finished third canto, so she won't have to do this. No. She can join in if she likes, but she doesn't have to. But Chandra Vallabhi. No, Ananda Vallabhi, that's her partner. Does he want to do it?
We've got only two members.
Beshko? Can I put you over here? They've only got two. Is that right? Where's Nanda?
Ah.
Not sure about. Oh, okay. Yeah, because you're doing bhakti sastri. Your name's not even here. Oh, I got to put it in here. That's right. All right. If you were doing it, where would we put you? Okay. The ashram guys?
We have to split the ashram guys.
Can I move? Hey? Well, yeah. I think, well, one thing is it's ease of working with each other. I don't think we should necessarily penalize devotees for being extra studious or, you know. So, look, we'll leave that there. Okay, I've got Nanda. Okay, Ananda Vallabhi, I'm not sure about. What about Nityananda Priya? I'll put him with. Now, where will he want to go? You think? So you've got a big man there. Okay. I'm going to put some